Do ugly shoes help knee pain?
Can we improve HIV treatment with patient navigators and financial incentives?
What about not using condoms if your partner has HIV?
And a really big study of big people.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
So Rick, I'm going to start with a matter that's near and dear to my heart. That's ugly shoes. And that's an issue relative to knee, osteoarthritis, and Annals of Internal Medicine.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that because I don't remember ever seeing you wear ugly shoes before. I thought this was a really well done study and answered a very basic question on a subject that we really didn't have a lot of information. We know that knee osteoarthritis affects about 10 to 25% of women and about 5 to 15% of men that are 60 years of age or older. We know that we have anti-inflammatory medications and physical therapy, but one of the recommendations has been to use specific shoes. These are called unloading shoes to help knee pain. We say, what are unloading shoes? The way the knee is constructed, a lot of the osteoarthritis takes place on the inside portion of the knee or the medial portion. The thought being is if you could wear shoes that somehow changed the way you stood and walked, that would put more of the pressure on the outside part, but nobody's ever studied it before. So in this particular study, they took 164 people that had osteoarthritis of the knee, and they randomized them to receive what you refer to as ugly shoes, or I'm going to call unloading shoes, or normal shoes. They looked exactly the same on the outside, but obviously they were different in how they functioned. And then they followed these individuals for up to a year, and they asked them, how's your pain? How is your function? And the individuals were encouraged to wear these shoes for 4 hours or more per day. What they discovered is that the shoes that were modified to unload had no benefit over conventional shoes. The, quote, ugly shoes or unloading shoes were no better than conventional shoes.
Well, I have to confide in you that I actually looked at some of these shoes yesterday just because I wanted to see, well, all right, let's take a look at just how horrible they are. Not only aren't they very attractive, they're also expensive. So I think this is really an informative study.
You're going to try something. You want to know if it's effective or not, especially if it's expensive. By the way, I need to correct myself. I said this was a one-year study. This was a six-month study.
Well, I'm going to finally say that I was really happy to see an objective assessment of these kinds of strategies because, gosh, they're just legion. When I walk through the aisles of pharmacies, I see a multitude of devices that are ostensibly going to benefit people with common medical conditions and or common physical conditions. So I'm really happy to see this study.
Good. Well, where do you want to move next, Elizabeth?
Well, even before we even move on to the next one, of course, this is the one I'm going to do on the blog. Let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. The entire issue this week is devoted to HIV and its management, and we selected two studies out of that issue. One of them was relative to, hey, can you safely forego using a condom if you have a partner who's HIV positive?
These are what are known as serodifferent couples. Of the couple, one member has HIV and active viremia. You can detect the virus in the blood, and the other person doesn't. And obviously, these individuals, you want to protect the person who's seronegative from developing HIV. Three most common ways is to make sure the person that is infected is on effective therapy to lower their viral count. Number two is to use condoms. And the third is for the person who doesn't have HIV is to take prophylaxis. Well, many couples, although well-intending to use condoms, oftentimes do not. What this study attempted to address was, in that circumstance where you have serodifferent couples in which condoms are not a part of their safe sex practice, and the individual that has HIV is being treated, what's the risk of transmitting that to the person that doesn't have it? To address that, there was a prospective observational study that was done at 75 different clinical sites in 14 European countries that identified almost 1,200 serodifferent couples, sometimes heterosexual intercourse, sometimes males having sex with males. And what they discovered over the median of 2 years is that none of the individuals that were negative contracted HIV infection from their partner. Now, again, their partner was being treated adequately with the proper antiretroviral therapy. Now, there were 11 individuals that did get infected, but not from their partner. It was a different partner.
To me, this is one more reason why people who are HIV positive really need to be on antiretroviral therapy. It proves, in fact, that they're not infectious under those circumstances.
trying to say that they're not infectious, so there's still a very, very small risk. But your point is very well taken. In fact, in this same issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, they talk about HIV treatment and prevention. And before, we used to recommend that people get treated only when their viral counts were particularly high or their CD4, their white counts, were particularly low. Now the recommendations are different. Once the person develops HIV, treat them, not to prevent opportunistic infections in them, but to prevent them from transmitting it to their partners.
And the price is going down, so yet one more reason to go ahead and go forward. Since we're talking about HIV, we're in this issue then. Let's turn to something else that you found quite tantalizing, this idea of patient navigation within the healthcare system when you're HIV positive.
This was a disappointing study, and actually surprising to me. It was a study done in hospitalized patients that have HIV infection and substance abuse. And these are individuals that are very high risk of transmitting HIV to unsuspected partners that are HIV negative. What we'd like to be able to do is, knowing that you can lower the risk of transmission if they're adequately treated, you'd like to take these hospitalized substance abusers and provide them people that coordinate their care and will help follow them and navigate the system, and even provide them financial incentives to be on appropriate therapy. If you do that, you have to ask yourself, well, how effective is that? So to address that, over a two-year period, these investigators looked at 801 patients that had HIV infection and substance abuse. These were from 11 different hospitals across the United States. They randomized them to three groups. Those with conventional therapy, they said, listen, go to a substance abuse center and get treatment. The second group, they had a patient care coordinator that arranged 11 sessions of coordinated care and case management and motivational interviewing. And then the third group, they did that, and they also gave them financial incentives. These individuals can earn up to $1,160 over the course of the 6 months. Unfortunately, in all three groups, about 35 to 40% of the individuals took their therapy appropriately. 55 to 65 to 70% did not, regardless of the special care that we provided to them. Now, I find that very disappointing.
It's extremely disappointing because, of course, it throws us back to the drawing board with regard to what strategies are going to be successful in intervention in this population.
Yeah, this was a very well done study. Well, where do we turn to next to try to make sure they receive this fairly inexpensive and widely accessible therapy?
Right. And on that note, I would just say that, of course, the substance abuse population has been a very, very challenging nut to crack, regardless of whether they're HIV positive.
Absolutely. And that's why I thought having someone spend special time with them and motivating them and even providing them money would have been successful. So it is disappointing that it's not.
Let's turn from here then to The Lancet. This was a really, really big study looking at obesity and death.
As I described it, a big study about big people. And you might ask, well, why do we need another study about obesity? That's because there's been some recent data that has suggested that being mildly overweight may actually have some protective benefits. So this is one of the largest studies we've reported on. It's over 10 million individuals. They specifically excluded people that had chronic disease, cigarette smokers, or people who would die within the first 5 years, suggesting that they had some sort of disease that could somehow affect the results. And what they found is that being just slightly overweight, BMI between 25 or 30, a BMI of 30 to 35, and then being more obese, substantially increases your overall mortality. Being mildly obese increases your risk of mortality by 45%. Having a BMI between 35 and 40 doubles your risk of mortality. And a BMI over 40 almost triples your risk.
This effect of obesity was also more pronounced in men, I believe.
It was more pronounced in men and women. And by the way, it was pretty much the same across all different continents as well. Overall, the relationship of BMI, body mass index, to mortality was pretty strong, and it was global. And why that's important is that there are now 1.3 billion adults worldwide that are just overweight and 600 million or more that are obese.
I guess the other thing we know about this, of course, none of this is any kind of a surprise. And I bet if we calculated the financial outlay relative to consequences of obesity, even mild obesity, with regard to the development of things like type 2 diabetes, I bet it would just be astonishing.
Type 2 diabetes, cancer, hypertension, stroke, you know, a number of reasons why these people die prematurely. And you're right, this is preventable because it's a change in lifestyle, so the cost of that can be very low. The benefits of that, both in terms of health and also in terms of the cost of medical care, are really high.
And of course, really high numbers in this study, so very compelling data. On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.